Hello, everyone. I'd like to talk about our big plans for Parallax this fall. Starting in September, me and my friend Nils Skoglund will be producing a series of courses we are calling Tools for Conviviality, named after a book by the late philosopher and social theorist Ivan Illich. Ivan Illich was a thinker for a time between worlds, or what he called a time of watershed. I know of only a handful of thinkers as prophetic and as prescient about the contemporary issues of school, medicine, language, and so-called machine intelligence and network thinking as Ivan Illich. But rather than study Illich directly, we will use his thinking as a prompt. Our ambition is to literally create tools for conviviality. Conviviality means, according to ChatGPT, the quality or state of being friendly, sociable, full of cheer and lively spirit. We should add adventure and learning. The series will be inaugurated by the wonderful Benita Roy. From her bio, Benita is a visioneer, insight guide, and horse whisperer. Her work is deeply embodied and grounded, and over the last several years, she's shown us how to trust the intelligence of life again. She is founder of Adelore Insight Center and curates wickedly provocative and seriously surprising conversations at the pop-up school. Her course, The Convivial Life, Conversations with Ivan Illich and Friends,
begins Sunday, September 10th,
and will continue every Sunday for the month of September. It will include pre-recorded lectures, live Zoom sessions, and campfire community sessions. For more information, and to join us in the learning and conviviality, please check the links below. Welcome, everybody, to Parallax, Parallax Academy. We are creating courses this semester based on the idea of tools for conviviality and generally based on the ideas of Ivan Illich's thought. And there's no better person to talk about Ivan Illich than David Cayley, who has written this magisterial biography of Ivan Illich and has known Ivan Illich for many, many, many years. And Bonita is going to teach a course starting Sunday the 10th entitled The Convivial Life, where she's going to explore some of Ivan Illich's concepts in her own particular style of thinking. It's not a survey course on Ivan Illich. It's more of a hands-on kind of affair. I wanted you guys to meet and talk about Ivan Illich together, and I want to kind of be in the background and just hear you riff a little bit, in the jazz sense, on the ideas of Ivan Illich. Do you want to begin, Bonita, and say something about the course, and then we'll move to David?
Yeah, and I do have a kind of set up questions or topics to talk about.
Good.
So
very good.
So I'm doing this course and it's called Conversations with Ivan Illich and Friends, because we're bringing in different voices, people he probably doesn't know because they're more contemporaries of ours. And so I'm trying to weave in this imaginary kind of pastiche of voices as if we were sitting around a table and being convivial. So I've been steeped in reading his work and reading other people's work. And so I just want to mention that, because as you might hear a mashup of ideas that aren't really true to Ivan, and then we can tease out maybe what he might have said in return or something. So there's a trope that's quite imaginative in this course. So I just want to let you know, because in my mind right now there's a big mashup of ideas. But I have two questions to start with, or three. And one of the things that, first of all, I think his work is confounding and enticing at the same time, right? Because you can't pin him down, and he's not in a package. And every time you try to think of, well, he's like blah, 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 he's not like other thinkers. But spending the last 6 weeks working through your work with him and his own writing, there's some kind of repetition in his his view of the history of the tools and the medicine and the education and the church and the state. There's some kind of template that repeats, right? There's the positive origin, then there's some kind of inflection point where things turn iatrogenic, or too much of the good thing is a bad thing. And I'm trying to wrap my head around what this trajectory is. And I imagine he would be appalled by trying to sum it up. But I ended up thinking of like, that the trajectory, this is my words, is something about, there's this progressive regression from direct contact and direct encounter, where I would say moral action is possible, to this ever widening gap somehow. So for example, I start with like the person to person encounter, the Good Samaritan, right, at the core. And then we have the person who uses a tool, but not in the bad sense of tool use, maybe the craftsman or the artisan or the baker, or the instrument, the musical instrument is a different sense of tool, okay? But then somehow that person becomes in modernity a tool person, not a person using a tool, but like a tool person. And then the tool persons get together and the professions, the disabling professions. See, there's this kind of like nested set, right? And then the professions become institutionalized, the institutions become systems, and now the systems are under the umbrella of the algorithmic computation. And my question is, and this is an argument that I'm not able to articulate well, because there's many of my colleagues who see this kind of complexification as the telos of the universe, that the universe is, you know, has single cells and then molecules and then humans and then systems of systems. And yet there's a certain way in which this is a problematic progression. So it's a big question. And I thought maybe you could, riff on that and speak to that.
Well, I certainly think that you're right to begin with. I mean, it's been said before. Heidegger says that every thinker thinks one thought finally. Bertrand Russell says that if you take someone's complicated philosophy, they'll always be a simpler mythic structure underlying it. So I think you're not wrong to see a constant, a template, as you said, through Illich's thought. And it is what he summed up to me in the expression, the corruption of the best is the worst. So that means that it may be that he has the general idea that anybody might have, that things tend to go too far, that the great thing in life is to find the point of balance, the happy medium, the point not of mediocrity, but of maximum tension between opposites, which are always trying to turn into one another. Well, that's a thought that can be thought in any circumstances or culture. To that, Illich adds his belief that the incarnation is best. That is, it is the revelation of the greatest human possibility, the highest human possibility. When that is pushed too far or corrupted or turned into its opposite, then a unique evil is created, a unique darkness descends. So something originally good is the key idea, I think, which might separate Illich and those of us who cleave to Illich from your friends who see an endless evolution, a progress that never ends, a complexification that just keeps getting better, right? Because some people would oppose a philosophy of being in which the original creation possesses authority, and a philosophy of becoming in which you don't have to keep returning to something. You keep going ahead, you become what you will be. So I don't know if that's at all pertinent to what you're saying. But yes, it's finally in Illich about recovering the source, which has been corrupted, but which is still there. That's the key idea.
Yeah, and then this is what I wrote, is that there's, of course, we can speak of it historically, but there's also like this much more metaphysical or mystical or mythic way to think of it. But you end the book with the rivers north of the future. I'm not sure where it comes in the other book, but this notion of enfleshment, that God didn't become man, he became flesh.
Yes.
I think is, and so there's a sense in which I think Illich is such a prescient and modern figure, but I think people forget that he's also deeply reverent Christian. And so there's something about the enfleshment of Jesus Christ and that reminds us that, you know, when he was on the cross, he says, "It is finished," that there's something that has been completed at that point in history, that is not this big, long trajectory, but it's maybe you could even say orthogonal to that. And I wrote down, the enfleshment means to remind us of the possibility of a direct encounter again, right? So you have the possibility of the direct encounter with God in Jesus Christ, and then you have the possibility of a direct encounter with the divine in the Good Samaritan. And this is what I think his pivot point is around this notion of Jesus, the incarnation, says, right here, right now, despite this trajectory, you know, that I'm describing as this regression, people who walked the world walked with Jesus. This is a direct encounter. This is the revelation right here, right now. It doesn't need, I mean, as humans, we're going to build on it and blah, 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 but it doesn't improve. It doesn't get better. It's already perfect in a sense. Does that, would that be in the spirit of Illich? That's what I'm.
I think entirely, yeah.
Yeah.
We can't improve on what is eternal. And so, yes, I think that's entirely within his spirit. And that is never lost, right? And that is a, otherwise, I mean, you can, if you want to put things in terms of pessimism, optimism, then you can read Illich as a deep pessimist whose pessimism kept deepening. But that isn't at all an accurate picture of this extremely person who was a lot of fun to be around.
Yeah.
And who at every moment was celebrating and believing that it remains at all times possible to celebrate, and that spirit that we're talking about is always discovered in community and is in fact defined by that.
Yeah, and in this direct in community, in this direct and simple and very human way, you know, which I think probably made him what made him fun to be around. And that word conviviality then comes out or is derived from that experience of community and communitas and this way of relating to people.
Yes.
I have another question. These are big questions, and then we could go to smaller questions. I guess that's my thing. I get to the big questions first. But so there's this beautiful passage. These books are beautifully written. and of course, when you know you take a one passage, this is in the section on embodiment and disembodiment. If you take one passage out, it kind of pigeonholes him. So there are other things he says afterwards. But I was struck by this one passage, and he says, when Paul speaks about the word being enfleshed or incarnated, we still speak about the incarnation, the enfleshment. He speaks about the emptying out of God emptying himself out. In the Greek word is kenosis. And I'm wondering how closely this parallels a more secular, let's say, metaphysics. And that is, so I'm writing this book called The Once and Future God. And its basic premise is that it's quite secular. But also religious at the same time. But the basis premise is that God as source, as the creator, is completely metabolized in their creation. So you can think of, for example, is the first amoeba around? Well, yes and no, right? Because the amoeba is completely metabolized in its own creation. And this sets up a peculiar frame of mind because in the peculiar frame of mind is this once and future God. So I think it doesn't match with Illich because it's not so, there's less eternal, you know, there's less of the eternal in it, and it's much more kind of an unfolding. But maybe you could explain more of what he meant by the emptying or this original notion of kenosis, which I think is fascinating.
I don't think it means for Illich that God has vanished, or if that's what you mean by metabolized. Can you hear the planes? Sorry. It's really quite loud. If it continues, I'll close my windows.
It's okay. Your voice is breaking up a little bit.
Zoom is trying to
Let me just wait. They're gone. I would say that in latter years, when he began to talk about the age of systems, he was lamenting the loss of transcendence, right? Of any standpoint outside whatever system is in question. So I think he always retains the sense of God as transcendent, so that it isn't an emptying in that sense, but it is, I think, an emptying in another sense, in that we encounter God in one another. That is the whole point, in a certain way, of the incarnation, that this possibility has been open to us, right? And he did certainly like to sometimes joke about this. He had a story he told me more than once that I've related in my book, but a young nun once asked him why God doesn't speak to us anymore, because evidently in the Bible, God is quite voluble. So what has happened? And then she, without waiting for his answer, she said, maybe he said everything he has to say. And Ivan loved that. I mean, I think he taught out of the mouths of babes. This beautifully expresses the meaning of the incarnation. So in another way, yes, we have been shown what to do, right? There's no, and this was the same, Andrew quoted this in his article. This is the same position he takes about prophecy. People are always calling him a prophet or saying, isn't this prophecy for a time that you're doing? And he always said, no. Prophecy is, in the sense you're speaking of, outmoded. It cannot be prophecy in our time because the word of God is with us, is among us, so there's no need for us to speak it beyond being friends to one another, reminding one another of this possibility that exists between us. So, yes, I mean, I've answered out of both sides of my mouth in a certain way.
It was a good answer because it made me realize the difference. And, I want to think more about this on my own, but the difference between, so does this concept of fully metabolized divinity get rid of the eternal, like the eternal, which is not in time? And that's an interesting question. And also, go ahead.
Well, I have a new enthusiasm. A writer called Eugene Rosenstock-Hussey, who I don't know if you ever read him, but I had known of him for years as an interlocutor of Rosenzweig's and in various ways, but never had read him. And I just read a book, I think it's called Future Christianity, not the Future of Christianity, written late in his life. But he says that Christianity has more than once gone bankrupt. And that it's bankrupt now. He's writing in 1945. And I found the expression interesting. It's out of money. When you're bankrupt, you're out of money, you're out of funds.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it's any less true than it was before. It doesn't mean that it won't begin again, die and be reborn. But it does say it's out of funds. And I think that out of funds may be out of words, concepts, tire, fade, die. Words are overburdened, lose their meanings. And we're in such a moment, I think, where it's very, very hard to speak. And in some context, impossible to speak.
It's interesting, one of the Paggio brothers,
Jonathan.
I don't know, Jonathan Paggio was, I was listening to a podcast and he was talking about how death of Christianity is built within Christianity. It's in the metaphor of, the central metaphor of Christianity, that it, maybe that's what it does. It dies and is reborn all the time, or something like that.
Yes, I think that's right. And that's certainly what Rosenstock-Hussey says.
Now, I think that one of the reasons, I mean, we live in such a ecumenical kind of environment, we're Christians that go to some monasteries and on, but I think if we put the two ideas together, what it what it, you know, it needs some kind of catharsis where the complexity is cut through, you know, like this cutting through, like this is what Jesus did. You know, you have the Pharisees and the some and all these, you know, the people in the temple and all the messiahs and the all the prophecies and stuff. And then there's a sense in which the incarnation cuts through and starts clean and simple, you know, it kind of like disestablishes the complexity, the systemic complexity. And maybe that's what happened. That's what needs to happen. Kind of like bankrupt is kind of a funny metaphor, like the central banks have to like go up the, and then the new seed, you know, there's a the new simplicity is made and yeah, so there's a sense in which that would be an approach that could revivify it to get back to some not a reduction of the complexity, but I call it releasing the complexity, you know. Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think he tries to do that a lot when you quote him in your books, because at one point he talks about the incarnation and he starts, you can hear him, or you've portrayed him beautifully, where he starts, you ask him a question and I can hear him being kind of cranky with you. And then he gets a little complex and then he goes, well, wait a second. There was a young girl.
Right.
And she was pregnant. And this is kind of the move he's asking us to do, like, you know, and so that's beautifully portrayed in the way you have this back and forth with him at the end, like we're, and yeah, does that make sense?
It does. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I put upon him considerably at various times. Yeah.
But he must have recognized that in his own mind, the trigger to start expanding the ideas and growing the canon and stuff. And I guess that's what he was criticized the church for, you know, instead of sticking to the core mission, becoming involved in politics and establishing these care facilities. This whole tendency for the incarnation then to be developed, embellished in these ways that diminish, like an embellishment that diminishes somehow.
Yes. Can I ask for a 2 second pause here? I'm going to close my window. Okay, that's better. It really is a little bit like being under aerial attack during this air show in Toronto. So I'm sorry, Benita. You were talking about simplicity and cutting through. And
yeah, no, I'm just speaking with you. You know, I've been working with these books, but speaking with you is helping me articulate what I've been noticing. And this, and just having said that about the complexity and the church gets to come. And then I noticed that this is the kind of breathing between you and him. And then I figure that this is what he experienced as a discipline in his own mind, you know, because he certainly was capable of showing the systemic complexity of like how the schools and the military and the language and the, you were all related in, we're all the same kind of mistake, let's say.
Yes, well, I mean, I think just biographically, he was a very, very precise, almost scholastically precise writer, and his books, the ones he called pamphlets, from Deschooling through Medical Nemesis, are extraordinarily closely observed and wonderfully delivered, but they seem to have missed a lot of people. So when I did the interviews with him at the end of the 80s, and then his friend Lee Hojnarski transcribed them, and I had no thought of making a book. It was just a chance encounter with a publisher that by which that became a book. But then we both had the experience of what that book meant to a lot of people who had been reading him, but had been missing something. Right? He was very struck by it, that people would come to him and say, well, I understand better now what you're talking about. So to be able to overhear a conversation, seemed to be a way people could see better how he thought, how he approached things.
Sorry, David, which book was this?
Well, it was Ivan Illich in Conversation.
The first conversation book, right.
Published in 92.
Well, I just want to jump in here quickly because I'm struck, like, there's an early career of his, and he was a big star in a sense, intellectual hero, and he kind of, people latched onto his ideas in a very revolutionary style, and then he just dropped out of it, out of the whole thing, out of the whole picture, and then his later career is almost deeper than his earlier career, but in a way I feel like in the course that Bonita's doing and other people, I sent them, you know, your book about, you know, Rivers North of the Future, and that this is another aspect of Ivan Illich, that the earlier stuff is like a subset of his larger view, which happens in his later life, it might be appropriate to bring that forth now, even more. Does that make any sense?
Yes. Well, I mean, there's only one man there all along, as Bonita pointed out at the beginning. And I think the way it all happened was moment to moment. I mean, it was not planned. I never knew a man who seemed to me more in touch with the spirit of his times in an exemplary way for me. And I think that was important, that he felt that's how he ought to live. So the long period of preaching what he called a new church, which ended with his Inquisition in Rome in 1968, and his decision that this couldn't go any further, that it would just be sterile controversy, and he shouldn't prolong it. It would be bad for the church, probably bad for him, that he should just stop. And he did effectively just stop. But I think the next period from de-schooling society or celebration of awareness through into the later 70s was entirely stimulated by what he understood to be the case and what he said clearly there, which was that he believed that what people now call the 60s was a moment of kairos, of altered time in which change might occur, and that he wanted to hold out that possibility that you could disestablish schools, that you could rein in the medical system before it became impossible for people to know themselves, to suffer, to die from themselves, because they wouldn't any longer, they would become terminally confused, right? Life would merge, the life, which for him is always the life more abundant, would utterly merge with the medical system. So it would become impossible for most people to disentangle them, and that they would come to feel that their duty to life is to live till the doctor says he can't do any more, or maybe until it's time for the doctor to kill them, as is now the case in Canada. So he addressed that moment as thoroughly as he could. And when he saw or began to see that all the myths, if you like, all the narratives people say now, in which these institutions were anchored, lay deeper than the level on which people were reading him. I wouldn't say deeper than the level on which he was speaking, because if you read Deschooling Society, you can already see what is made explicit in The Rivers North of the Future, that he sees the school system quite clearly as a church. And even there's a story he related it, that as soon as he went to Puerto Rico as vice rector of the Catholic University in 1956, and for the first time in his life was confronted with a school system on which he had to reflect, he immediately sniffed a completely religious atmosphere, he said. So the ideas were there all along, but he was trying to speak to the moment in the terms in which he thought the moment demanded. And speaking personally, the most dramatic instance of that was a moment that occurred outside Emmanuel College at the University of Toronto after a conference we'd both been at. And I had asked him the day before, when I had to do an interview relating entirely to the subject of the conference, whether he would be open to be visiting him and inquiring, you know, doing a longer series of things about his thought. He said it was completely out of the question. He didn't want to do such things anymore. And then the next day, while we were standing outside in the sunlight, he glanced over at me and my wife and children who had come to see me, and immediately you could see had changed his orientation and said, well, why don't you follow up what you said? And both our lives changed at that moment. Mine, obviously, because I got to do what I wanted to do, but his, because the books that I did changed the way he was understood and received. And at the very end of the conversation in 1988, when he broached the idea of corruptio optimi pessima, and my jaw dropped open, and I thought, I don't understand this, but I need to understand this. And I then pressed him, which he allowed me to do, till the material that became the Rivers Notes of the Future after he died, after his death, which was his development of the idea, as he put it in a little bon mot, that modernity can be studied as an extension of church history, that the entire fate of the West is summed up in this turning inside out of Christianity and can't be understood, can't be properly or fully understood in any other way, that wouldn't have happened if that first moment hadn't taken place outside Emmanuel College. I never would have been there to knock at his door, and maybe nobody else would have knocked, and maybe it never would have occurred. Now that astonished me, because, you know, most of the scholars I've known have patiently, laboriously written out their understanding, created their system. Ivan wasn't like that. he might have let it go because he didn't feel himself to be in charge. He didn't feel himself to be creating his own path. He felt himself to be living responsibly in the moment, waiting for intimations of what he should do. And he summed that up in this expression. He'd like, I fear that the Lord is passing me by, or that the Lord will pass me by. In other words, that I'll miss the moment, which might not recur. He didn't see history as repetitive. He saw moments to which we will or will not respond, at which everything could change, which is the essence of a messianic view, I think, right? That everything, that there's another world hidden just behind this one, but which is never able to emerge because there's never enough of us attentive at the right moment to allow it to.
It's a question of attention, isn't it? That's the whole thing.
It's a question of attention, yes. Mm. Yeah.
You know, I love that, because one of the voices I'm weaving into this course is a book by Warren Heidi, Attending as an Ethical Art.
Oh, nice.
And and so that just really feels consonant or resonant with how I'm portraying these voices around him, and also Jan Zawicki and her notion of lyric philosophy.
Aha! Uh-huh.
Do you know her? Yes. And
I don't know her personally.
Once upon a time, I have the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one's. Yeah. So these are like, we're trying to create a family. She says lyric philosophy is not like analytic categories. They're like families that hang together. And so this notion of these voices hanging together.
Right.
And so, yeah, this notion of attention. And this is also, we spend some time in the first thing about tools. There are tools that, like, I have a visual of a archer, you know, a young woman studying archery. This is a kind of tool that enhances the quality of attention, right? Versus something like the internet, where I just point and click. The action thresholds are lowered, but through convenience, right? And it does the opposite to attention. So I try to call these things that, I try to make the distinctions between these two qualities that tools, and he said the same thing. He says there's two qualities, ones that enhance human something, I have a quote, and then ones that, and then there's the tools that become your master, and then your executioner. But I'm trying to reclaim this notion of tool as a musical instrument, or like the archer, like, and I think, because I think he doesn't spend a lot of time on it, but he does appreciate the discovery of tools, and he says in the book, and I have this whole scientific article on how it's shown that when, like, they took these people and they taught them how to flint rocks to make arrows. And it took them some like 300 hours to get good at it. And then they studied the changes in their brains, and that tool making has so many, it's so intimate to us. It's made us who we are, and made us how we build and make things. And I was trying to voice this different felt sense between a tool and an instrument, you know, and the instrument has something to do with attending.
Yes. Well, that I mean, that was a huge thing with him. The difference, I mean, you know, the words can be set up in different ways, but if you make the distinction tools instrument, right, then he has a very interesting account of instrumentality and how it emerges through the corruption of the best.
Yeah.
Through a certain you're being upstage there.
So, yeah, that's the problem with that term instrument, because it can mean this wonderful thing, and then there's instrumental reasoning, which is a perversion of this other thing. Should we move on? I have another big topic.
Yes, absolutely.
Visiotypes, plastic words.
Oh, God.
So in this journey, like I've been doing this journey, I started to see, okay, so one part of the course is called the AI apocalypse, because AI and the algorithms as tools. And so language can be an instrument. We can sing with language, and yet it obviously can become a tool that is our master and then our executioner. And maybe you could tell some stories about how he talked about visiotypes. Just to introduce that to our readers. It's not very often talked about, and I caught it this time. It kind of...
Well, the idea of the visiotype, I think he discussed with, and I think Uwe Perksen, who was a friend, an interlocutor, a professor at Freiburg, in older German literature. They met at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Berlin in 1980, the Wissenschaftskolleg. And I think in reading Uwe, Ivan found an interlocutor for this idea that he's already sounded in deschooling society of amoeba words, right? Words that have no boundaries. Words it's the germ of the idea of what they together came to call plastic words, and then Uwe wrote it all out in a book called Plastikwörter that my wife Jutta, who's German born, and I together rendered into English. And unhappily, it's out of print, so it cost you about $2,000 or something on Amazon. If you look it up, it's kind of terrifying. But it's in some libraries, and I'm hoping we'll get it back into print eventually. But Uwe developed the idea of the plastic words, and then he went on, and I will in a minute, to what he called visiotypes as the kind of visual or imagistic equivalent of a plastic word. But a plastic word is, as he defined it, is a word that has come out of the vernacular and gone through a kind of scientific laundry. So communication's an old English word. You'd find communicating passageways or, you know, all sorts of connections described as communication going back hundreds and hundreds of years. But that word is then plucked out of the vernacular, and it goes through information science and comes out smelling of science or of expertise. It has an aura, and it can then be used in somehow, you know, the famous line from the movie Cool Hand Luke: "What we have here is a failure to communicate." It's a kind of archetype of that, right? As if that's more than saying you don't understand each other. Communication is potentially supervised by an expert who understands how it should be done. And all these plastic words have experts supervising. So they become something, they become something like Lego blocks. You can build discourse with them. You can build, you can say that information is a process of communication, but you could just as easily say that a communication is a process of information, or you can make little Lego cities out of them, and they're all connotation. They have no denotation. They have no time. They swallow history. They swallow time. They're a kind of imperialism. And so now to move to what Ivan and Uwe called a visiotype, that's another kind of imperialist, right? Which also swallows up meaning. I mean, I think the word that's most prevalent now that sums this up is icon. You couldn't turn on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, and listen for more than an hour before you heard of an icon. Anybody who's, you know, it's everything is iconic. And it's a unit of stereotyped meaning, right? In an environment where there's too much talk, there's too much information, nobody knows what's what, the icon or the visiotype somehow focuses significance. It enables you, but it's a stereotype, so it can't be changed, right? The primary quality of conversation, Ivan says, is that my words can be turned around in your mouth, or your words can be turned around in my mouth. So there's a living relationship in which the meaning is not fixed, right? In the visiotype, in the plastic word, the meaning is fixed, inert, given. It probably possesses a value, perhaps a monetary value. One of the things that Andrew will appreciate this, because he's a great admirer of Leonard Cohen. I listened once, this is a long time ago, when I was just figuring out what was happening at the CBC, and the now disgraced John Gomeshi got an interview with Leonard Cohen. And Cohen was in Montreal, and he was feeling whimsical. He wanted to talk about the old days in Montreal, and Gomeshi wouldn't let him. He had to march him through the stages of what I understood to be his iconicity, right? Leonard was not allowed to behave as anything but an icon. That's sacrilegious. You're an icon. You've got to behave like an icon. Like there was a fixed quantum of blessedness in Leonard Cohen, and Gomeshi had access to it, and it was his job, which he was determined he would do well, to distribute that blessedness to the people listening to the CBC. It was seen to be entirely a kind of religious, but not recognized as religious, ceremony that was being conducted. But it's all
idolatry, right?
It's a kind of idolatry, yeah. Idolatry would be a good name for it, yeah. Anyway, I'm banging on.
So I just want to ask you, if you awake in the middle of the night disturbed by Illich curdling in his grave, because these things he's predicted have gotten very, very bad. I love your illustration of Legos. These plastic words can build entire cities, and he talks about how they have this, because of the way we're educated to them, you use this word and it imposes a frame or a mental model in the person's mind. Like if I say yes. LGBT, the whole conversation is now is completely blocked out in this person's mind. And if I have any kind of status or power over you, you have no chance, right? Because I just say this word and the whole thing is blocked out. No, you can't choose your own frame. Zach Stein calls them thought terminating cliches or thought terminating stereotypes. But this is almost all you see now. And this, I think, is what, you know, these language modules are perpetuating. They can do this because language is no longer alive. So people think that these modules, these AI modules are talking. And the thing that excites me, and maybe not a positive way, is that there are many people who on the surface would agree with what we're saying, but they use language in this completely connotative way. I mean, they just use one metaphor that refers to another metaphor that refers to another metaphor that refers. It's like a word salad of crossing metaphors, and there's no contact, as we were saying before. There's no contact with ordinary experience or the revelatory power of friendship, let's say. And so for me, even my own community, and I actually accuse people of doing iatrogenic soteriology. Like my own community is like, we try so hard, and yet I think there is an inflection point in our own like spaces. I don't know, I don't mean to rant, but language starts, so in this process of working, language starts to be extremely, like you say, he starts with this criticism of institutions and stuff, but then he starts, I think language becomes very, very key in a certain way.
I couldn't agree with that more. I've just finished. After I published that big Illich book, my task was to try and devise a book on the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, where I did all this work and worked most of my life. It came out rather long, so I'm intending to rewrite it this fall at about half the length. But a great concern of that book is with language, and with, you know, if I try to think of the proper uses of public broadcasting, especially given the desuetude of the university, then I think of it as reviving language, as reviving conversation, as reviving thought. And it's not easy to talk about, but what you just said is crucial, right? You cannot think in pre-formed units that all have a sacred aura attached to them. You can only move them around and you know, you can strike postures with them, right? You can position yourself with them, identify yourself, identify others, but you can't think. And it's my contention that thought in that sense is what is most urgently needed, because of the bankruptcy that we referred to before, right? So, end of the lesson.
My question would be like, how do we do that? How do you do that kind of thinking? That kind of.
I think
it seems to me. It seems to me it has to be.
You do it in an exemplary way. That is, persons do it, and other persons catch the spirit from seeing that it is being done and can be done. I don't think there's any method. Right? I think method is exactly the problem, right?
Well, there's this word egregore that has become popular, which means like a collective spirit that is created, a kind of demon out of language, right? People get together and they develop an identity around a bunch of concepts, a bunch of these kind of amoeba words and concepts, and then they create the pseudo religion or whatever. And I'm wondering about the difference between exemplary like speech and thought and that, and how do we parse that out? How do we figure? See, I guess I think it's, again, it comes back to attention, perhaps. I'm not sure, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're asking whether there's a criterion of the real, right? Or not. Mm. So, for Ivan, Christ is the criterion. Gandhi called his autobiography "The Story of My Experiments with Truth," and he has. Although Gandhi is not exactly not a Christian, if I can say it like that, he has a piece of Christianity in him, but he's not a Christian in a formal sense. But his book is really about the empirical test of truth, right? By their fruits, you shall know them. I mean, you always end up with metaphors of taste, right? You always end up with metaphors that refer to the senses, I think, don't you? He who has ears to hear, let him hear. By their fruits you shall know them. Ivan put great stock in the sense of smell because he had a big nose and he liked to joke about it. but, you know, he would often indicate that. But sometimes he would make this gesture with his fingers at the same time as he was sniffing. But it's okay, so what's you're smelling it, you're feeling it. There's always, you know, you're reaching back for the authority of what is, right? Are you then reaching back to the creator of what is? Well, then we run into a lot of difficulties in how we're talking, right? And what different people mean by different things. I came across I spoke of this enthusiasm for Rosenstock Hussey, but in this book that I was just making notes on this morning, it starts with a quotation from Hugh of St. Victor, which is interesting because Hugh of St. Victor, as you'll probably both know, was an intimate of Ivan's, one of his historical playmates. And Hugh says that the church has existed from the beginning of the church exists from the beginning of the world to the end of the world. And that there at no time has Christ been absent from the world. Now, I immediately thought of Simone Weil, who takes issue with Catholic doctrine precisely on that point, saying but she's querying then the form the idea of the incarnation takes. If it only occurs at a certain moment in history, then what about the people before and so on? Or what about the people who only hear the good news when a Spanish gunship.
What about the Buddhists?
Yeah, or when a Spanish gunship lands on their shores 1,500 years later to tell them the wonderful news. Yeah. So it's very complex. And I think Ivan himself, in the spirit of Bonhoeffer, although he almost never speaks about Bonhoeffer, maybe they were just operating on parallel tracks, but in the letters and papers from prison, Dietrich Bonhoeffer speaks about religionless Christianity, an idea that he really didn't have much chance to develop before he was executed. But what, and the same idea is present in many thinkers in the 50s, and it certainly was present in Ivan, who really was trying to return the church to something. This is a problematic way of speaking, but irreligious in the normal sense of religion. The question is really needs to be carefully defined. But he talks about the laughter and the joke. He really talks about an institution that's not an institution, that is really the breath of spirit. It's the meaning of things. So it's pretty far away from what is normally thought of as the Christian religion. So I'm wandering far afield here, but I think we're going to need what Hugh calls the church that has always existed. And we need Christ as the criterion of the real, but it's the Christ that has always been, and not the Christ that most non-Christians feel is the 7-foot rabbit, as my Jewish friend Richard likes to joke. You know that old movie about Harvey? Only James Stewart can see the 7-foot rabbit. I think it's called Harvey. But so Jesus is the 7-foot rabbit, according to Richard, which we have some fun with. But anyway, I'm wandering. I think you may regret your jazz invitation there.
No, that's for me. Sorry, I'll pass it on to Benita in a sec. This is very relevant because I meet a lot of people who are Christians that are not religious. I think I meet a lot of people like that, that are very, they feel very Christian, but they can't find an institution that they can belong to.
Right. So I wrote down a couple of things. I mean, there's so many touch points here, so I don't think you rambled. I think you seeded a whole garden, some weeds and some flowers. And some vegetables and some fruiting things. There's a lot of seeds there. So I tell my students that we're in the business of planting weed seeds because
we eat a lot of weeds around my house. Yeah,
they grow faster. People get confused by them. Okay, so you said, I mean, you got very serious there. We probably can't unpack this whole thing, but we're talking about touching base with reality, right? So and truth. You know, the root of truth is troth or trust. So these are all the kind of the weeds that the seeds in this garden. But what I want to talk about, and you said Simone Veil, she's in our course because she quoted a lot in this book on attending. And Jan Zwicky, they both talked about the sacred. There's, you see, we have everything is kind of upside down, right? There's like an inversion, right? What do we say? The education makes you stupid, the money makes you poor, and the medicine makes you sick. and the religion makes you evil or something. This is where we're going, right? So, and what it is that, in my opinion, there's one of the things he's talking about from these tools to professions is like this larger and larger systemic generalization. And so Wiki and Vail are talking about attending as an ethical act, but they're talking about like, am I in relationship with this particular person, this particular flower, this particular porch even, you know, in terms of the design of our built environment. And from that relationship comes a transcendent reality. And I think we're too quick as moderns to start talking about the transcendent reality as if we have a purchase on it and get away from the things, you know, and it's this, you know, the divinity in the joke, right? The divinity in the, it's, and I love what you said. It's like when you talked about how at first, when you asked him to do the book and he was going to pass on that, right? Maybe it irritated him, but then if you attend to these experiences, these events in a certain way, you can start to recognize those that are coated with grace, I would say, that there's a certain quality of a certain number, there's innumerable ones once you get going, of events that come to you with like a certain amount of grace in them. And you can learn to, I call it understanding the causal manifold, that's kind of a fancy term, but you can learn to, and they come in particularities. The particularities are wrapped in a certain type of grace, and you can start to recognize those in the middle of this chaotic, apocalyptic, maybe reality we live in. And I think that's a practice that is inherently sacred and spiritual, and not religious in the sense that we were saying, you know, not religious. And then the other thing, and that particularity comes with a kind of intimacy. Now, what do I mean by intimacy? My God, now I'm going to rant. So I'll take my ranting time now, my coupon here. I'm going to trade in my coupon.
We accept it.
Only had one. So like reality, like one of the things, the way I look at it is that like a beaver's in a pond and he's in the habitat called the pond. But as he maneuvers in the pond, the exterior reality ingresses into him as a certain kind of knowing or awareness. It produces a subjectivity. And this is true for us also. And so when we swim in a certain kind of language, that produces, it ingresses into our interior as a certain type of subjectivity. And this is, of course, the importance of where your kids go to school, because when what's inside of them is a reflection, is borrowed, is imported from the world they're swimming in. That's one thing. And then I'm just dropping seeds too. And the last one I want to say is, there's, I think, to me, if you use, I'll first tell a joke. So I used to torture myself writing these long metaphysical treatises on things like, why is there an apparent telos in the universe? And I would work and work and work and meditate on it. And then I would get this insight. And time again, the whole project I was working on could be summed up by like a 6-sentence phrase from the Bible, you know, like, but you didn't see it until then, right? You didn't, like, I'll remember one of my big projects, and I woke up and I realized it's when Christ said, you know, the lilies in the valley do not toil. And I'm like, that's all I'm saying, actually. I got 600 pages here, and that's it, right? So my point is this, is that there's something mixed up about the way we use symbols or parables. Like when you think of the image of Jesus as the good shepherd, the image is powerful because of what, I mean, I live on a farm. I know what it's like to care for animals, and we live next to a state park. And this dance between caring for animals, but letting them be in nature, but then they're at risk, and the non-duality of life and death. This is what a shepherd lives with. This is the entanglement, the deep entanglement of the shepherd. And then it's taught as, oh, Jesus is the good shepherd. And it's some kind of laundered, socially condoned metaphor for like some childish relationship to God. And so what happens is we invert the metaphor. The metaphor works because there are real shepherds. And it really requires attention and the transformation of self to be a good shepherd. Not to be a good shepherd metaphorically. That's the illusion. We're talking about the experience of a real shepherd, you know? And so like I talk about how there used to be a time when if you were a doctor, you could be a doctor and that was a career that you could grow wise in. Because you lived in place and you saw people born and you saw them grow up and you saw people have heartaches and you, and but these, you can't grow wise in a profession anymore unless you're something like a shepherd, literally, not metaphorically. And so I think that this is all part of language, it's all like I was once in a workshop on sense making, and I did this presentation on landscaping and the making of place and stuff like that. And then the participants had to go out and do projects. In one group project, they were using placemaking as a metaphor for sense making. And I'm like, no, it's the opposite way around. The word sense making is a virtual word. It's a metaphor for what was actually the root, which is placemaking. And what we live in this kind of like disconnected cross metaphorical language laundering. And we think that's sufficient to stand in for what is actually where the metaphor and the symbol comes from, is from something particular and real. And so that's the word garden.
Language laundering is a very good one. I like that language. I want to just keep that language laundering word. And then that will become another amoeba word if we coin it and put it on the internet.
As placemaking has become also.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can't avoid that. The word that keeps coming into my mind as you're speaking is limits. And that was from beginning to end, Ivan's project, right? And I think it's a very big and resonant idea, and yet an open idea, because it's quite a puzzle to try and understand. Even in Tools for Conviviality, he admits that he can't say precisely where a limit is in a given situation, because it depends that the human equilibrium, as he says, is always open. So where it's going to be found, it's going to be found by some people in this situation. But the idea is to have the idea that there is a limit, that there is a point of enoughness, and that there is an iron law. Ivan never says this. This is closer to Carl Jung than Ivan Illich, but I would say it, that there is an iron law by which things pushed beyond that point gradually become their opposite. But limits are the boundary of something. They're the proper size of something. They're the point at which a situation is going to turn into something radically different. And they also then take the form in his later thinking, and this never developed. When he started to lecture at the McCormick Theological Seminary in the later 80s, and as much as he did on the idea of corruptio optimi pessimo was started in there, but he also proposed to do a series on what he called ascesis. He didn't want to say asceticism because he felt like that already somehow misled people into thinking this was about a hair shirt or about some kind of self-mortification or perversity that they would associate already with older religious forms of thought. So he called it ascesis. Well, using the Greek word probably isn't a big help, but he wanted to think that through. What would be a modern asceticism? And there are a few essays that are, you can find them online, guarding the senses, guarding the eye and the age of the show, various attempts he made. But I think it couldn't be more germane at the moment, because without limits, without a boundary, and we're lost. We're abandoned to the limitless. And I mean, in the age of social media, for example, right? Which, I mean, arguably we're in the midst of a communications revolution that isn't comparable to anything, to take you back to the printing press, really, to find anything comparable to what it means to have people, I was a broadcaster. Well, everyone's a broadcaster now. It's quite a revolution. I mean, that's an astonishing revolution, but I don't think there's any way to create a protocol that doesn't involve standing back, limiting, pitting a medium against medium, finding a way to preserve one's own integrity, to know who I am, what I mean when I speak, to not be engulfed. Has to be within limits.
I'm wondering what philosophers did Illich read. Did he read like Hadot or Guattari? Like, what philosophers did he read that informed him in some kind of casual way that wouldn't make, the resource list in his book or something?
I never really knew Benita. So Ivan's reading or lack of reading is quite a study, and I don't think I know that much about it. He obviously, when he took on a subject, he made himself equal to it. He mastered the literature of the subject, as you would see in gender or as you would see in medical nemesis, which are two of the most thoroughly resourced books. He was certainly very well versed in Catholic philosophy. So I think Perswara, Roman Guardini, all, you know, von Balthasar, de Lubac, I think he was very well grounded in the thinkers of Ressourcement, as it was called in the Roman Catholic Church, those who were kind of going back to the origins. But I'm not at all sure about the rest. Did he ever read Heidegger? I don't know. There's plenty of common ground. Did he have a more than superficial knowledge of Sartre? I don't know. So I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, because in doing this work, preparing for the course, I found myself in these imaginary assumptions that, oh yeah, he got this from Heidegger, like you're saying, but yet he doesn't act like that's where, you feel like you assume that he's in this milieu, but then there's something about the crispness and the uniqueness of the way he says things that, you know, he's working it out for himself. And so then you wonder, that's where my question comes from. You know, you wonder.
I mean, as a person who has lived in the milieu of media and made something of a study of media discourses, I think he certainly abstained from a great deal.
Yeah.
He largely abstained from cinema. He may a few times have gone to the movies. I remember him saying that he was too much impressed by it. But then he didn't take that on to learn how to not be impressed by it, or to develop whatever was necessary so I think, you know, there was a time when he read the New York Times in the early 60s, but I think he stopped. So I think he was very much himself ascetic.
Well, it's interesting maybe that that his thought could be defined in some ways or characterized by what he didn't, you know, what he didn't read or experience, or because that would give him a unique perspective in a world where everybody is experiencing all this stuff.
I mean, I'll take an example because this is important to me. He wrote a couple of essays about life as a modern idol that were extraordinarily important to me, and which I think probably in Nietzsche give you the key to what has happened in the last few years, where it's possible now to see that life of a certain meaning, and with a certain priesthood protecting that meaning, is now the sovereign. It is the sovereign entity in which the world is governed, because I mean, I don't think the world has ever been governed before as it was during the pandemic, where practically the whole world population were thrown into turmoil over something that at the time it was done was you would almost say notional. Nobody exactly knew what this novel virus was. Nobody knew its infection mortality rate. And yet the entire world was shut down and, you know, massive harms were generated to people behind this. And I think, so that's the power of life as sovereign. But anyway, he has just these couple of, this one major essay about it. It was a lecture he gave to the Lutheran Church in 1989. He did a radio program with me about it, which was the biggest, which I still remember in a career when normally some reaction would come back to things I did. That was greeted by an amazing silence, as if it was just as if I hadn't spoken. But you would think if you were going to develop this idea of life, you would go back to Nietzsche, right? You would go back to Schelling. You would trace this term through Romantic philosophy and on into Nietzsche. But he didn't. He didn't. He left. So he left a great deal obscure in that respect, which is perhaps a good thing.
It's a good thing because it allows us to maybe, because there's a big space for us to contemplate. Is that what you mean?
Yes. And maybe he didn't know what he wanted to say about that, or, you know, if you read him, his means are always carefully limited. And that's very admirable, I think.
You know, one of the things we've been doing in my course is we've been looking at, I don't know how to frame it, but we've been looking at what Greg Enriquez calls the justification system and justification. Yeah. And we do this funny thing in my course. This is a little controversial. I'm going to say it anyways. But we look at two documents. We look at Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, which is the most beautiful document of justification ever written. And we look at Bio Akamalafe's essays on Black Lives Matter, but to whom? And you can see that Bio's not using justificatory language. Yeah. He's in the business of persuading, but there's a trap in the justificatory process. And I think this is something Illich intuited, that at a certain point, maybe another one of these limits, you know, if you're quoting Nietzsche and if you're going through all this process to justify something that ultimately you feel is such a foundational truth, it's self-evident, then you're going to kill your own message, right? Yes. I'm going to say this is a truth that if you just could see it, it's self-evident. Now, Nietzsche said this, and this said this, and Aristotle said this, you know, and I think he intuited that. And so that's a kind of limit, but it's also very smart. It shows he understood that language is an instrument, not a tool, right? So like when you push language into these huge justificatory systems, it no longer persuades, it just slides, right? So that, this is the first time I'm thinking of him in that category. So that's very interesting.
I like your distinction very, very much. And I think it applies.
Yeah.
I think it applies. And I think he was entirely aware of that.
Did he ever talk about Taoism and the early Chinese sages? Like, he's kind of a Taoist in my eyes, but of course I'm kind of a Taoist, so I project that on him. But this notion of this being vigilant crafty with language, suspecting language, very Taoist, tools, limits, hard constraints on reality.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that I never talked to him about it.
I want to induct him into the Taoist Hall of Fame.
I've been reading the Tao Te Ching all my life.
Yeah, me too.
Hardly a day goes by that I don't read it.
Yeah.
One stanza. And yet I never asked him about it. And I never knew. I think in general, he was a bit allergic to the wisdom of the East, probably.
I use
the expression hoping that it'll sound like a cliche.
Yeah, but maybe because
There was a lot of that around.
Yeah.
And I think in that sense, he reacted to it.
Okay, so now.
Uh-oh. You haven't even started yet.
We're just getting started. We're just warming up here, tuning the instruments.
This last 20 minutes, this is a conversation between me and you, Mr. Right. Cayley, because right. You said you've been living with the I Ching. Okay. The Tao Te Ching. But you're familiar with the I Ching, kind of?
I am familiar with the I Ching.
Okay. So I have this crazy idea, and I don't know anyone to run it by, so I'm going to run it by you. Right here on Parallax.
Okay.
It's a big moment on Parallax right now. That's about to happen. I can feel it.
So we felt into this whole thing about language and the vigilance and the language laundering and stuff like that. And I think we understand the parameters they're talking about. And then we have this phenomenon of large language modules. And I'm writing a series on... It'll be in the course. We'll send you the course videos.
That,
yeah. Which are very provocative. I don't explain or justify a lot. I just we plant these seeds like we've been doing. But I have this intuition, and that is, so we know what the large language modules do. They don't think. They just have probabilities that one word will follow another, blah, blah, blah. But the I Ching is kind of like a large language module, but it's not the same kind. Like, for example, the interpretations are digests of different thinkers. And so in that sense, it's a compendium, it's a compression. But each of the hexagrams is a protocol to take a certain kind of action in a certain kind of context. Right? So it's like, in this case, if you're in this context, be yielding, but if you're too yielding, then you'll be that. It's like this balancing act. So it's not telling you a proposition. It's not telling you sentences. The interpretations do, but it's built on what I call action protocols or protocols for action. And in a sense, for me, Illich's story, The Good Samaritan, is a robust action protocol. This you can use all the time. It is a universal law, all right, of goodness or something. And so in my mind, I'm like, could we use AI, the evil AI, to generate not the kinds of things it's doing, but the kinds of things the I Ching is doing? I don't know the answer. It's just this big thing I'm playing with. But okay. The question is, what is the I Ching doing? What is the Tao Te Ching? Is similar? If you use the Tao Te Ching by randomly picking it up, which I do often, it's kind of works like the I Ching. But how are they using language? It's an interesting question. It's something that I'm very interested in.
Can I query something before we go on to this? The interpretation of the parable of the Samaritan seems to me to say that no one can tell you who the neighbor is, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you recognize the neighbor, right? Well, in this case, it's the guy in the ditch, but the point of the story, Illich says, is the guy in the ditch couldn't be more implausible or improbable as a neighbor than, right? Right. These are enemies, effectively enemies who are. So there couldn't be more distance to cross between them. So how is that a rule?
It's not a rule. Okay, so this is
what did you
question.
Say it was?
Action protocol.
Action protocol. So I have to use a special term, but okay, let's go back to the Good Samaritan. We use E.E. Cummings' wonderful poem called The Stranger. And at the end of it, he's like, from whom the stiffened puke, you know, the guy's got a hard on and his flies open. I picked him up all into my arms. And we say, my course, the story of the Good Samaritan doesn't work unless if you're not initially disgusted. You're disgusted, and yet it's the "and yet" that is powerful. I'm disgusted, and yet. Okay, so that's a little bit of like how implausible. And why did the "and yet" come right now? We don't know. Am I open to the "and yet" coming? And so a parable is a kind of action protocol, if you understand it, that works. So and the I Ching is sort of like that, and the Tao Te Ching is like that. It's like it's very interesting. What is that language doing? I see it as an answer to the trajectory that Illich is critiquing with this trajectory that a lot of things are on, but that language is on. And I just took the liberty of asking you because you said that you've used those texts for a long time, and it's an interesting question, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, not sure I have anything useful to say about it. I mean, if I read a stanza of the Tao Te Ching, let's say before I meditate or something, you know, I guess it's an action protocol. I'm looking for a way to orient myself.
Right? Yeah, or
is that what you mean? Is that what you mean? It's an
it composes
orienting
you,
idea
or experience. It composes. Yeah. It composes the instrument.
Yes. Okay.
In a certain way, that then works across context. You know, so you don't have to be magical and think, oh, the randomness and the things. It's like, I mean, when I was a kid, I used the Bible that way. I used to use it as a prognosticator.
Yeah.
And it was very frustrating because I always ended up on Job. And my whole life I've had animals and loved animals and they've always died and it broke my heart 100,000 times. Anyways, and so I think there's a contribution to be made in this question around that. I don't know. It's going to be in the course, and this is a little intro to the course, but if you ever have any ideas around it, it would be really interesting. It's an interesting question because we moved from not justificatory to, you know, like,
yes. Yeah. Well, it's a rich thought, I think. But I mean, it, the thing that makes language non-instrumental in this context is that I'm responding to you, or you're responding to me, right? That so it's the spur of the moment that calls the words in some practiced but still unpremeditated way forward, right? So, and I mean, I guess the parable, the poem, the stanzas of the Tao Te Ching, I guess they all have that same character, perhaps.
Does this have something to do with, let's, the protocols have something to do with, well, it seems to me like there's the limits, right? Which is kind of, you create a ritual of some kind, or you, you know, you read your book, you read your Tao Te Ching, or you make an offering, or there's all kinds of ways that you can change your state of mind so you can enter into attention in a deeper way. Is that what you're saying, Bonita? Like something that
I think it has something to do with things like that. I think the Tao Te Ching, the I Ching, and parables have something to do with limits and boundaries. I think what I call them robust protocols. I think they understand something, like a hard constraint of reality. Like one of the hard constraints is, things have their limits, and when you push them too far, they will turn into the opposite. This is very Taoist. You go too young, you become yielding yin. So it's like underneath the protocols, because I don't want to call them rules or instructions or whatever, they're based on a handful of what I would say are hard constraints or laws or limits. I don't want to use words that come with baggage, like scientific laws, but I would say that this is a way to reanimate language at a more social level. I think what is especially more beneficial is what you said, to have actual conversations in intimate space. Let the, you know, if I swim in this conversation, then a part of Andrew and a part of Dave is ingressing into my subjectivity, right? So, but for a document, you know, at the level of a document, social document, I'm very curious of what is it that these language compendia, this kind of thing is doing.
But this is, since we are being spontaneous, I remember the scholar, his name was Bert Hamilton, he's no longer alive. He was expounding Northrop Frye to me, and he had been a student of Northrop Frye's. Frye was a great Canadian literary critic. And he was exploring the idea of chariots of fire, which is in William Blake, right, in the poem that is in Jerusalem, and it now is known as Jerusalem. Bring me my chariots, you know, bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariots of fire. And Bert said that he thought that for his mother, Anne of Green Gables functioned as such a conveyance, as a chariot of fire. And his point was that anything that was beloved and taken in a certain spirit could have that character of a conveyance, of a way of an imaginative shape. So I don't know if it's restricted to the certain kinds of protocols as you're saying, or whether there are a lot of such things that a lot of doors that open in different ways for different people.
Well, that's an opening for more conversations.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking there's the formal version of that, which is like, I was thinking of, you know, there's religion. And well, you made some interesting comments about post-Christianity, or not post-Christianity, sorry, post-religious. I can't remember what the phrase would be.
Well, Bonhoeffer says religionless Christianity.
Religionless Christianity, right. And so I had an image of, you know, John Coltrane blowing his saxophone or something like, yes, Love Supreme. It's not within the church, but it's equally as powerful or probably more so usually.
It's not in the lines, but it's in the groove.
Yeah, but then maybe there's something primordial to the rituals of the church and things that are cause that kind of spontaneous, or cause that kind of creation.
Well, I mean, for me, you know, you get this people opposing spirituality and religion, and it's always made me really uncomfortable, because I think they're a pair in a certain way, right? What is meant by the two things are a complementary pair. They're not one. I should do one or the other, right?
That's it, yeah.
So if it weren't for religion, presumably we wouldn't have the Gospels. If religion means the institutional container by which they were, within which they were created, but also by which they were then preserved and transmitted. But at the same time, when the life goes out of certain words, certain concepts, certain ritual actions, then it's time to fearlessly devise new ones. And I think what Illich's position was in the Roman Catholic Church, the part that nobody seemed to, or at least his superiors, didn't understand well, was that he always insisted that tradition and innovation were an utterly interdependent pair, that they defined limited, enabled each other in a way that would make either one by itself futile and reckless. The tradition by itself would stultify, and that innovation by itself would go off half-cocked. So that they had to be thought together. I think it's the same with any new concept of a church or of any that innovation. Yeah, I think
innovation depends on a certain limits and orthodoxies.
Yeah, and
something like that.
A root, and similarly, tradition has to be constantly renovated and re-understood.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, that was the conclusion I came to about Illich in my big book. I don't know if it's right about him. It's certainly where I've got to. It's certainly right about me. It's where I've got to in my understanding. That's ultimate. In a passage that's always been important to me, and I've been meaning recently to go back and look at it and see if I've understood it right, is in Nicholas of Cusa's The Vision of God, where he says that God is perceived as a coincidence of opposites. But he uses the image of the wall of paradise. So at the wall of paradise, at the limit of our understanding, presumably, we perceive God as a coincidence of opposites. But in his image of the wall of paradise, there are openings. And angels seemingly are coming and going. So there seems to be an implication that there's something beyond that wall. But there are no words necessarily beyond that wall. It's the voyage onward from there is in silence, possibly in darkness. So far as we're in the world, we're in a world that has been made of opposites and perhaps can't be made in any other way. We don't know that, but we know that that's how it's made. We walk on two legs, that every word is in dialectical tension with some other word within that word, or some opposite word, and so on and so on and so on. So we live always with this doubleness. Which is part of limits too, I think.
Beautiful, yeah. I think you've made me understand the limit, the concept of limits in a deeper way. So how are we doing? Bonita, do you have any more questions or?
No, I mean, we could dive in deeper. I could just say something else about the course. So one of the voices we bring in on this question of tradition and innovation is Christopher Alexander in his book, Notes on the Synthesis of Form. And he talks about, you know, when architecture as a discipline was created, he sounds very Ilyich-like. He says it was doomed at its inception because it tried to divest itself of tradition and taboo. And tradition and taboo is part of the intelligence, a larger intelligence that creates living forms. So I just want to say that a lot of these things that Ilyich is provoking is called into conversation with some of the other characters that we will look at. And the exploration is just the beginning of where people might want to bring it into this questions that we had about action protocols. There's so much generativity in starting with Ilyich and your work. I see them as twins, you know. There's a twinning going on. You talked about doubling, but with yourself and Ilyich, there's some kind of twinness going on that I think is really appreciated.
Yeah. You know, he may have known Chris Alexander.
Yeah, really.
He was a good deal in that California milieu. It's not impossible that they met. I don't know that they did.
Yeah, I think they had the same kind of personality constitution, you know? Yeah. Do you hear that?
That's your dog.
That's my alarm clock. They know exactly when to run.
All right, let's go.
Okay. Well, yeah. So we're going to round it out then. Anyway, this has been an extremely rich conversation. We seem to have dived in very deeply to, you know, dived right in the deep end, right from the beginning, it seemed like. And so that's, I always like that. I always like to feel on the edge of things in a conversation. So thank you very much, both of you. And I hope people will come to Bonita's course, and I hope people will, you know, learn more about Ivan Ilyich and perhaps investigate David's book and books on him, which are wonderful. And yeah. Any last thoughts or?
Well, I'd just like to say thank you to you both. That was very interesting, surprising, and enjoyable.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I wanted to, in real life, try to get some of the spirit of these naughty, both N-A-U-G-H-T-Y and K-N-O-T-T-Y kinds of conversations. I really appreciate the energy and enthusiasm of both of you. Yeah.
Yeah, we like naughty conversations at Parallax. So thank you very much, both of you, and have a great evening, and we'll talk soon.